Welcome back to One Step Beyond. We are now proceeding with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. Those of you who were tuned in just a few minutes ago heard me talking about Mae Brussels having been driven off the air, and also about how Mae has been warning for years about what happened in California under Governor Ronald Reagan, warning that basically California was a testing ground for American fascism, that ultimately what you saw in California under Ronald Reagan would extend to the rest of the United States, also probably under Ronald Reagan. In 1975, Mae was predicting that Ronald Reagan would become president of the United States. People dismissed her as lunatic at that point and on that subject, as they have so many times. Her prediction doesn't appear to be too lunatic today. Those of you who are familiar with the Christic Institute suit against 29 different figures in and around the Iran-Contra scandal are no doubt familiar with the Rex 84 martial law plan. We've spoken about it in the past on our Radio Free America shows numbers 31 and 32 in the our Radio Free America series on the Iran-Contra scandal. The Rex 84 martial law plan, basically a contingency plan to establish martial law in the United States, goes right on back to Louis Giuffrida in his work with Edwin Meese at San Luis Obispo, and their mutual work on operations Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, provisional plans for martial law in California in the United States back in the late 60s and early 70s when Ronald Reagan was governor of California. Giuffrida, along with many other members of what people have referred to as the California Mafia, jumped to Washington with Ronald Reagan, and the predictions that Mae made in 1974 in her article on the Symbionese Liberation Army in the Realist magazine have turned out to be only too true. Fortunately, the revelations in the Iran-Contra scandal prevented, at least for the time being, the institution of Rex 84, the martial law plan, which we felt was, in fact, an updating and adaptation of the King-Alfred plan, a contingency plan for interring and perhaps exterminating all black Americans. This be the Rex 84 plan being an updating and adaptation, apparently, of the King-Alfred plan to Central American refugees and their and sympathetic white or Anglo protesters in the United States. By way of, I guess, a sort of memorial to the work of Mae Brussels, obviously her work remains as a foundation to our work here to a considerable extent, and as a way of looking both back at the failures of the past, namely the failure of the American people, of the progressive forces in this country, to recognize properly what is in fact going on, their consequent failure to gain adequate control of the political process, and the resultant failure, the derivative failure, of the more progressive elements, and at least with regard to Central America, they are in a majority. Polls have consistently shown that 70% of the American people oppose Contra aid, and yet the Contra war continues to go on. That's because the American people have not got control of their political process. Had certain interests perhaps paid more attention to people like Mae Brussels, and Mae Brussels in particular, rather than turning up their nose at her, others like her, and the work that they were doing and attempting to do, we might not be in the situation we're in today. I'm going to take a look now, or we're going to take a look, at a prediction in the past that turns out to have been a very, very accurate one and holds some unnerving implications for the future. This is what Mae Brussels was trying to warn about for many, many years, what she's going to continue to warn about in print. This is what people are dealing with now, as we observe the total autonomy of the military and the national security establishment with regard to their actions, not only in Central America, but elsewhere. Just remember that there are people that tried to warn about it. We're going to take a look now at one of those warnings. This from a book, Anti-California, Report from Our First Parafascist State. That's by an author named Kenneth Lamott, L-A-M-O-T-T. The book is copyrighted in 1970, although it was first copyrighted in 1963. The copyright here is from 1970, and it's published in hardcover by Little Brown and Company in Boston. Reading now from Anti-California, a report from our first parafascist state. Now, Lamott, again, is taking a look at California in the 60s and early 70s and is predicting certain things about the United States from his experience in California and saying that basically what he has seen in California is going to take place in the United States. And there's an interesting section here in the book, adjacent to a picture of Ronald Reagan against the background of an American flag, a la George C. Scott in the popular motion picture Patton. Lamott writes as follows, "Here in California, we are, to begin with, governed by charismatic buffoons, men so clownish it is hard to take them seriously as politicians, but men who are not reluctant to use their tremendous powers. We are the garrison state preeminent, with a third of our people depending for their daily bread on the production of bombs, missiles, napalm, and all the other obscene items found in the modern catalog of death. In California, war is literally the health of the state. We are engaged in open warfare against an internal enemy who is often described in terms that would have instructed Goebbels. That enemy, of course, is our own young people. And later on in the book, the willingness of these buffoons to use their unlimited power is worth speculating about and worth reflecting on as we take a look at Lamont's predictions from 1970. And again, by way of memorializing Mae Brussels' work, by way of noting the failure of far too many Americans to take note of that work, and by way of hopefully pointing us in a more constructive way in the future, I think we should reflect upon Lamont's predictions at the end of this book for what is going to happen in California and the United States. And again, he saw California not only as a precursor for what would happen in the country as a whole, but also as a kind of a metaphor for the United States, as a microcosm, if you will. And again, the passage I'm about to read is a forecast from 1970. Lamont writes in Anti-California Report from Our First Parafascist State as follows. To recapitulate, then, what I have argued in this book is that the traditional forms of American life have been disintegrating faster in California than they have been elsewhere, and that we are in the midst of a profound reorientation in a new direction. The process of disintegration is visible both in the breakdown of individual morale and in the growing impotence of such institutions as the universities, the churches, the political parties, and the labor unions. For the individual, life in California is oriented toward leisure rather than toward work that has some meaning for its own sake. Marriage and the family are becoming increasingly insecure. There is a growing familiarity with death, either symbolic death with alcohol and other drugs, or vicarious death through employment in the garrison state, or literal death through suicide. The forces of darkness are breaking through the sunlit surface of California life, announcing their presence by means of such phenomena as the murderous history of the Charles Manson family and the brilliant and tragic career of Angela Davis. Skipping down. Political power in California has fallen into the hands of men who are not politicians in the customary sense, but who have no reluctance to extend their areas of control. They have made their essential orientation clear. It is anti-youth, anti-intellectual, anti-minority, anti-dissent, pro-police, pro-property rights. Their power is cresting. When I consider the future of California, I see a reconstruction of our collective life that will lead to internal harmony and order, but that will make California an impossible place in which to live. I see, first, the progressive atrophying of such political life as we now enjoy. Choice in the political sphere will become increasingly restricted. Whether the governor is Mr. Reagan or whether he is somebody else will not make much difference. The movement of California's political life will be toward preserving stability at all costs, ultimately at the cost of eroding the Bill of Rights. People will be imprisoned for political reasons, and cause will be found to keep them in prison. Privacy will be invaded to a degree unthinkable 20 years ago. Computerized dossiers will be maintained on all dissenters and potential dissenters. News will be managed, and thought will be controlled. Unless I am much mistaken, the rebellion on the campuses has about run its course. Bear in mind, this is 1970 when he's writing. The love generation is certainly gone. The counterculture of the young will be remembered as a brilliant and threatening comet that will not be expected to return. The political ghosts of Mario Savio and Angela Davis will be invoked to legitimize the suppression of whatever mild rebellion raises its head. The next generation will be silent, clever, and biddable. That, of course, is an interesting prediction and a rather accurate prediction of the yuppie puppies about which so much has been written in the 1980s. Continuing with Lamont's account, given our national leadership and the state of the world generally, I do not see much chance that California will be required to plow under its missile factories and napalm plants. Instead, we will become increasingly dependent on war as our one-crop economy. The brightest of the new generation of young people will be enlisted in careers in the war industries, and they will learn to go willingly. The relations between the races will worsen rather than become better. The more mobile middle-class blacks will escape to join their white brethren in the suburbs. Los Angeles, Oakland, and San Francisco will become dumping grounds for semi-employable black no-hopers. When civil disturbances occur, they will be stamped out promptly, bringing to bear all the technology of repression that has been perfected to cope with the campus. When blacks and browns are gassed, clubbed, killed by gunfire, and arrested collectively, there will not be as much protest as there was when white students were the victims. Yet the blacks and browns will manage to burn the cities, and great areas that once housed people will be allowed to stand as monuments to death and destruction. We will welcome this new world, for we ourselves will have made it. We will insist that we are living in the realm of Eros, but the temple we will have built will be occupied by Thanatos. The rhetoric will remain that of the promised land, but the reality will be closer to George Orwell's nightmare. We will give away the truth by destroying ourselves literally and symbolically at an increasing rate. Alcohol will remain our principal anesthetic, but marijuana and the less virulent narcotics will be increasingly used in wider circles than they are now. Our madhouses will overflow. There will be an increasing number of suicides that will be hard to explain on any rational basis. And so, in the end, the land that Walt Whitman described as, quote, a flashing and golden pageant, unquote, and that Mark Twain called, quote, the crown princess of the new dispensation, unquote, will indeed become our first parafascist state. As California has gone, so eventually will go the rest of the United States. Words that I think were haunting, perhaps considered paranoid by some in 1970, words which in 1988 must be regarded as a very accurate forecast of the history that has befallen us in the time since. We're going to break again from music and come back with what I feel to be the most important stories of the past week, and they have nothing directly to do with Central America. Welcome back once again. Now we're going to begin with the articles from tonight's broadcast. The section of tonight's broadcast that I'm about to do is going to go as an addendum to the archive show from last week about the Nazi euthanasia programs and their applicability to the analogs, I should say, the analogies to today's situation. In my opinion, the most important development of the past week had nothing whatsoever to do with Central America. A brief account of it was carried in yesterday's San Jose Mercury News, yesterday being March 19th of 1988. This is a small story in the National News in brief headline, Mercy Death Author Wins. This is relevant to a recent editorial from the New York Times that we read last week, in which an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association basically advocated mercy killing by portraying a very favorable first-person account by a doctor who performed a mercy killing. A prosecutor was attempting to get the journal to disclose the name of that physician so possible charges could be filed, inasmuch as a legal murder had in fact been committed. However, a judge upheld the right of the journal to keep that information secret. That article again, Mercy Death Author Wins. A judge on Friday in Chicago quashed a subpoena in which a prosecutor sought to force a prominent medical journal to reveal the name of a doctor who wrote an anonymous, first-person account of a mercy killing. Quote, we're very pleased with the decision. We think it vindicates the decision to publish it, unquote, said Kirk Johnson, counsel for the American Medical Association, which publishes the Journal of the American Medical Association. Chief Cook County Circuit Judge Richard Fitzgerald ruled the state attorney general's office failed to prove a crime was committed and had not exhausted all other avenues to obtain the information as required by the state's free press law. Well, the major point from the broadcast of the archive show put on last week was that the Nazi extermination programs, their broader extermination programs, such as the so-called Final Solution to the Jewish Problem, grew directly out of their euthanasia programs, out of the T4 project, the Tiergartenstrasse 4 project, the killing of mental defectives, in other words, retarded people, people with mental afflictions of one kind or another, the very old, the very infirm, and so forth. We took a look also at how the Nazi euthanasia program stemmed directly from broad international intellectual and social movements at the time, namely the very closely intersecting, or the very heavily intersecting, international eugenics and international mental hygiene movements. We took a look at how key intellectual figures in Germany from the eugenics movement and the mental hygiene movement were instrumental in implementing not only Nazi racial hygienic policy in general, but specifically the T4 project. Some of the key physicians involved are Drs. Alfred Plätz, Dr. Ernst Rudin, Drs. Lenz, Fisher and Bauer, Dr. Verschuer, and a fellow named Dr. Werner Villinger, also Drs. Philip Bühler and others, and many of these people had direct connections with the Third Reich. Again, we looked at that last week in the material from Bernhard Schreiber's The Men Behind Hitler. One of the key points in the program last week, again, was that the German people became acclimated to the idea of killing by first introducing legalized state death in a relatively palatable form, and the mercy killings of horribly deformed and or ill people became the way in which the German people were introduced to the entire concept of extermination. And we saw how the Nazi euthanasia program under T4 served as the training ground for the personnel and the perfecting ground for the tactics later used, the technical know-how later used in the Nazi extermination programs, their broader-based programs. I'd like to review now a very important part of the broadcast last week, and something which will look ahead to the next article, and again, by way of comparing the situation in contemporary America with that in Weimar Germany. Now, the information from The Men Behind Hitler that I'm going to review concerns the Naur case. Now, this was a case in which a man called Naur from Leipzig in Germany wrote to Hitler and asked for permission to have his horribly deformed daughter, deformed from birth, put to death in order to relieve her suffering. Hitler eventually granted this power, and his permission, this granting of the permission to put this girl to death, served as the legal, moral, and legal and moral basis, actually, for the Nazi euthanasia program. This was the legal loophole used to justify both legally and morally the subsequent Nazi euthanasia program, which in turn gave rise to the broader Nazi extermination programs, both conceptually and directly. That is to say, the personnel and techniques that were used under euthanasia then find their way directly into the broader Nazi extermination programs. Reading now from The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber, published by Section 5 Books in San Francisco. The first English-language edition of this book was published in France in 1972. This is copyright by Section 5 Books, San Francisco, California, February 1983. It's a softcover edition. And of the Naur case, Bernhard Schreiber writes as follows. The next step, towards the end of 1938 and the beginning of 1939, was publicly tested in Germany after endless discussions and propaganda moves. A letter addressed to Adolf Hitler, written by a man called Naur from Leipzig, asked for permission for a doctor to shorten the life of his child, who was born blind, seemed to be an idiot, and had only parts of its arms and legs. The child itself was at the time at the children's clinic in the University of Leipzig, which was headed by Professor Werner Kettel, professor for neurology and psychiatry at the same university. At the time, Kettel was already an exponent of euthanasia and has remained one to this day, which fact he acknowledged in his book, Border Situations of Life, Contribution to the Problem of a Limited Euthanasia. It was Kettel who made the suggestion to the father, or at least focused his attention in that direction, to write a letter to the Führer. As an answer to this letter, Hitler sent his physician, Professor Karl Brandt, to Leipzig, and after consultations with Kettel, put the child to sleep. Several months later, Hitler signed a document authorizing Dr. Karl Brandt and Reich leader Philip Bühler, B-O-U-H-L-E-R, to permit euthanasia in special cases. This authorization was supposedly signed in October of 1939, but was backdated to the beginning of September of the same year. The document was really nothing more than an authorization and formulated in such a way that a doctor who truly felt bound to the Hippocratic Oath could interpret it in such a way that no one would have to die. The Führer order, as it was generally called, had apparently come about after a lively discussion between Dr. Karl Brandt, Dr. Leonardo Conti, and Philip Bühler, and was as follows. Reichsleader Bühler and Dr. Brandt, M.D., are charged with the responsibility of enlarging the authority of certain physicians to be designated by name in such a manner that persons who, according to human judgment, can, upon most careful diagnosis of their condition of sickness, be accorded a mercy death. Signed, A. Hitler. In spite of this, the document was regarded not only as a legal basis for the crimes committed by the psychiatrists of Nazi Germany, but later at the Nuremberg trials and in other court cases, it was used as a justification where the accused attempted to interpret this authorization as an order. That last sentence again. In spite of this, the document was regarded not only as a legal basis for the crimes committed by the psychiatrists of Nazi Germany, but later at the Nuremberg trials and in other court cases, it was used as a justification where the accused attempted to interpret this authorization as an order. And again, that is going to echo, or we're going to find an echo of that in some current developments vis-a-vis healthcare right here in the United States. And we're going to take a look at an article, in my opinion, the second most important story to appear in the news media this past week in terms of overall broad implications. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, March 14th of 1988, we're going to read an article called Trauma Over Healthcare by Sabin Russell of the Chronicle, subheaded High Costs of High Tech. And the article is going to begin with an unnerving echo of the Naur case that we just reviewed. Last week in a Missouri courthouse, Joe and Joyce Cruzan pleaded with a county judge for a chance to let their daughter die. Comatose since an automobile accident 5 years ago, 30-year-old Nancy Cruzan has been kept alive with a tube for food inserted in her stomach. Her parents want the tube removed. The Missouri Attorney General says the forced feeding must continue. It is a question, he says, of state law and medical ethics. Taxpayers foot the cost of her care, $130,000 a year. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, basic economics, not theological theories or ethics, are prompting different life and death decisions. The city's growing deficit is pushing San Francisco General Hospital to cut $9 million in services for the poor. With such conflicting priorities, America's healthcare system is stumbling toward a financial crisis of frightening proportions. Americans last year spent $2,135 on medical care for every man, woman, and child. The nation's doctor bill last year topped $499 billion, 11% of gross national product and nearly twice the cost of national defense. Healthcare has become an economic cancer in this country that is threatening our prosperity, warns former Colorado Governor Richard Lamb, director of the Center for Public Policy and Contemporary Issues at the University of Denver. Signs of severe financial strain are cropping up everywhere. Health insurance bills this year jumped 20% to 40%, and medical costs have been growing at twice the rate of inflation. The ranks of the uninsured are growing. 37 million Americans have no medical coverage. At least 700 hospitals nationwide are expected to close down by 1995. Funds for preventive medicine are being cut, leading to far more costly crisis care. What is going wrong? Many analysts point to high technology, long the source of pride in U.S. medicine. Americans love high-tech care, said Berkeley business professor Susan Bartlett Foote. We're real interventionists. We want the latest in technology, and there is enormous pressure on doctors to use it, unquote. Microelectronics has brought us medical marvels such as CT scanners and magnetic resonance imaging machines, which can paint accurate pictures of the soft tissues inside the human body. But the machines cost about $2.2 million each, and a single session on one can cost $950. Heart transplants at $125,000 a crack have become almost routine at Stanford Medical Center. At University of California at San Francisco Medical Center, liver transplants cost $160,000 and a bone marrow transplant $100,000 to $150,000. Genentech's blood clot dissolving drug tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA, can help heart attack victims for $2,200 per dose. The Burroughs Wellcome drug AZT, provides the most effective treatment in prolonging the lives of AIDS patients, but it costs each patient $8,000 a year. The cost of continued scientific breakthrough is beginning to outstrip the ability of most Americans to pay for them. High-tech medicine has become a wedge dividing the quality of care available to rich and poor. I'd like to jump back again to an editorial from the New York Times that we read last week. This was a New York Times editorial from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, April 3rd of 1986. Actually, this was originally from the Village Voice. The article is called Sliding Toward Euthanasia, written by Nat Hentoff, and skipping down into the article. As for the long-range effects of the AMA's ruling, Dr. Norman Levinsky, chief of medicine at Boston University Medical Center and a prominent medical ethicist, told me, this gives doctors and other caregivers a message that it's okay to kill the dying and get it over with. It ought to be difficult for doctors to stop doing things for their patients, but this makes it a little easier. Also, it is not a huge step from stopping the feeding to giving the patient a little more morphine to speed his end. I mean, it is not a big step from passive to active euthanasia. Levinsky is also concerned about the effect, this, by the way, is an AMA ruling that passive euthanasia was okay. Levinsky is also concerned about the effect of the AMA position on what he calls the making of medical decisions according to class. I have no question, he says, that some physicians and other caregivers consider the life of someone over 80 to be less worthy than that of someone who is 28. The approval by the AMA of withholding food and water could accelerate that kind of medical care. And again, returning to the San Francisco Chronicle article from this past Monday of March 14th, the cost of continued scientific breakthroughs is beginning to outstrip the ability of most Americans to pay for them. High-tech medicine has become a wedge dividing the quality of care available to rich and poor. Today, one in five Californians under the age of 65, nearly 5 million citizens, do not have any health insurance. Half of them are working people, a third of them are children. When the uninsured need medical care, they turn to the county hospital system, which is run out of money to do the job. State funds pay only part of the costs, the counties must pick up the rest. San Francisco taxpayers last year paid $24 million to make up the shortage of state money. The financial gap in 1983 was only $600,000. But as San Francisco's budget crisis demonstrates, county hospitals can no longer count on their communities to bail them out. Basically, the jig is up, said Carol Emmett, executive director of the California Association of Public Hospitals. Without concessions from the state government, there are going to be massive service reductions next year, unquote. And skipping down on the article. Average life expectancy in America today is 75 years compared with 70 when Medicare began 2 decades ago. Per capita hospital costs for men over the age of 65 are 3.5 times the cost of care for younger men. Medicare expenses for patients in their last 30 days of life topped $6 billion last year. Check that one again. Medicare expenses for patients in their last 30 days of life topped $6 billion last year. AIDS is also contributing to our medical financing crisis. The disease could add $10.8 billion to the nation's health care costs by 1991. Well, again, not only the ominous echoing of the Naur case in the beginning of this story, but the obvious parallels between certain aspects of the Nazi euthanasia program and the situation today, namely the use of basically what in business is known as cost-benefit analysis to begin indoctrinating people to the idea of thinking of human beings in terms of dollars and cents value. Initially in Germany, people grew accustomed to the idea of killing people by seeing people whose lives theoretically didn't have much value. In other words, very old people, very sick people, very infirm people in one way or another, seeing them put to death. And then gradually it became easier and easier for them to rationalize the putting away of other types of people. And again, I think there are some ominous echoes today of what was happening in Weimar and later parts of the Weimar Republic and during Nazi Germany. As we look around today, we see, obviously, the possibility of a very, very disastrous economic collapse. Most people are agreed that there's going to be a serious, serious economic downturn. People disagree on when it's going to happen or how severe it's going to be. But it looks, basically, to anyone with a certain amount of information concerning the world economy, that there's going to be a major, major depression pretty soon. I think the pressure to eliminate certain less socially desirable, unquote, types of individuals is going to increase as the world economy turns downward, and it appears that it's going to turn downward. It's pretty obvious that they're not building shelter and they're not building medical care facilities for the poor. They're not building transportation. The cost of cars are going up. They're not building mass transit. It doesn't seem to me that any serious provision is being made for poor people today and disadvantaged and disabilitied people today. I think in the event of a serious economic crisis, I think the pressure to move in the opposite direction will be even greater. Don't be surprised if eventually we see something like the T4 project, the gradual acclimating of the American people to the idea of legalized state murder, beginning with very unfortunate, quote, uncurable people, and then moving to people who might be slightly more curable, but perhaps not a whole lot more socially desirable. Again, quoting from that New York Times article, from Thursday, April 3rd, or that San Jose Mercury News article from Thursday, April 3rd of 1986, a Nat Hentoff editorial from the Village Voice headline, Sliding Toward Euthanasia. And that editorial concluded with this passage, and again, we read this last week. I'm going to echo it again this week in the addendum
to the last week's archive show. Many physicians seem to believe it essential that only they determine the ethics of bringing a life to an end. This disturbed one of them, the late Dr. Leo Alexander, who was with the Office of the Chief Counsel for War Crimes at Nuremberg. Last year, philosophy professor Patrick Durr wrote in the Boston Globe that Dr. Alexander had been much distressed at a New England Journal of Medicine article by a group of doctors advocating the starvation of certain kinds of patients. "It is much like Germany in the 20s and 30s, Dr. Alexander said. The barriers against killing are coming down," unquote. And again, I'd like to review another section of The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. This also, obviously, with some unpleasant echoes as we look at the economic crisis vis-a-vis healthcare in the United States. In his book, Into the Darkness, Nazi Germany Today, Lothrop Stoddard, an American social Darwinist, racist, and pro-Nazi, had the following comments to make after a visit to Germany where he had looked into socialized health and the eugenic courts. He states that in a conversation with an earnest young man who was officially in charge of the tuberculosis section of the Public Health Service headquarters, he was told that, quote, "the treatment given a tuberculosis patient is partly determined by his social worth. If he is a valuable citizen and his case is curable, no expense is spared. If he is adjudged incurable, he is kept comfortable, of course, but no special effort is made to prolong slightly an existence which will benefit neither the community nor himself. Germany can nourish only a certain amount of human life at a given time. We National Socialists are in duty bound to foster individuals of social and biological value," unquote. And again, one of the central points of the broadcast last week was that the Nazi extermination program grew out of the euthanasia program, which in turn grew out of two broad-based international intellectual and cultural movements which were closely involved with each other, namely the international eugenics and international mental hygiene movements. Many of the elements involved with the Nazi euthanasia programs, which had stemmed out of the eugenics movement and mental hygiene movement in Germany, were then reincorporated into the international eugenics and mental hygiene communities after the Second World War. And again, one of the points that we have made so often on these broadcasts over the years is that the Third Reich was not an aberration. We've taken a look at the profound connections between major American economic and industrial institutions, financial and industrial institutions, and the Third Reich, the support of such institutions as General Motors, Ford Motor Company, Standard Oil of New Jersey, and others for the Third Reich. We've taken a look at how the top Third Reich espionage people and scientists were reincorporated into the United States at the end, or were incorporated, I should say, into the United States at the end of World War II in the persons of not only the Galen Organization, but also the Project Paperclip scientists. And the same point is to be made with regard to the euthanasia program and its direct connection with the Nazi extermination programs. The international eugenics and mental hygiene movements are alive and well and are as active and present in the United States as they were at any time. And that as we look at the Nazi situation, it shouldn't be thought of as something that's far away from us. It's not something produced by a crazy little man with a mustache. The international eugenics and mental hygiene movements are, they're not to be redundant, but they're international in scope, and they are mainstream intellectual movements. They are not something which, they're not an aberration. Nazi Germany was not an aberration. It grew out of certain definite trends, and trends which are unfortunately very much connected with our situation today. So I think the gradual sliding toward euthanasia, as Nat Hentoff referred to it, is to be regarded with the greatest amount of concern, because in the event of an economic collapse, in the event of a severe depression, and with the reactionary political tone of the times, I think we could very easily see something like the Tiergartenstrasse 4 project instituted in the United States. And again, bear in mind the Naur case, where this very, very deformed little girl was, or actually, I guess they didn't say it was a little girl, very deformed child, was put to death supposedly mercifully by the Führer and at the request of the child's own parents. And again, the similarity between this case and a lot of cases that we're seeing in the news today should be borne in mind. Again, the Nazis used a tactic which they called salami tactic. It was derived from the idea of slicing salami in very thin slices. The idea was to do things, to institute their program so gradually that each step was not very much worse than the one that came before. In this way, many people failed to note precisely what was happening. And I think the relevance of euthanasia, both for early Nazi Germany and for contemporary America should be viewed in this context. And once again, this particular section of the broadcast, which comes from March 20th of 1988, will serve as an addendum and postscript to the broadcast from last week, even though in many ways it reviews a lot of the same information, or it intersects heavily with the broadcast last week. I'm going to review another section from last week's program. Again, this will go into the archives also, a repeat bit of archival material here. I'd like to reread a section from They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1933-45, by Milton Mayer. This is published in softcover by the University of Chicago Press and copyrighted in 1955. Now again, what Mayer is writing about here, he's quoting a German university professor who is relating what the experience was like to live during the rise of the Third Reich. And I think, again, the gradual acclimation of the German people to official state-sanctioned killing and the growing trend toward euthanasia in the United States as one answer to the growing cost of high-tech health care. I think the salami tactic of the Nazis and the perhaps gradual acclimation of the American people to state-sanctioned murder should be borne in mind. Reading from They Thought They Were Free, again, a college professor's account of what it was like to experience the rise of Nazism. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness than most of us. This is the place to begin. Excuse me, I got a little confused. I thought I misread my own notes here. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us has ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion, regretted, unquote, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures, unquote, that no patriotic German, unquote, could resent, must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. How is this to be avoided among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principis obsta and finem respice, resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly, and how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might. Skipping down. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next, and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it is not just fear of standing alone, that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist, unquote. And you are an alarmist. You were saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have, But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller. Attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, some of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next step. Step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you at step C? And so on to step D. Well, today we are in a position to know the ends. We have the historical record perhaps to guide us, so I think it is incumbent on us, as we look out on the present situation, to bear in mind how the Nazi T4 project gave rise to such institutions as Auschwitz. And indeed, Professor Verschuer, one of the key exponents of the international eugenics and eugenics and mental hygiene in Germany, went on not only to become a key official with the Third Reich, but one of his students was Dr. Josef Mengele. I think it is worth bearing in mind the Nazi T4 project and its implications for today. We do have the historical record to go by, and so it is an incumbent on us not to lose sight of that. As I say, this particular section of the broadcast, even though in many ways it is repeated material from the archive show from last week about the T4 project, will go as an addendum to that particular broadcast and will be on permanent file with archives on audio. We're going to take another musical break and then come back with the next portion of tonight's broadcast. Step beyond. We're going to continue with the prepared portion, and then we'll be taking phone calls probably 9 o'clock or shortly thereafter. One of the things that we've been focusing on, actually, we're going to look now at something which may represent the intersection of two major topics of discussion here on this broadcast for some time running. We've been talking for many years on this program about our theory that AIDS is, in fact, a biological warfare experiment, specifically the application of genetic engineering to warfare, and there is massive information backing up that hypothesis. That information, by the way, is carried on Radio Free America show number 16 and its various addenda, some 4 or 5 to date, with more coming up quite soon. We've also spoken about the King Alfred Plan. That is a document supposedly fictional, but in fact apparently only too real, which represented a contingency plan by the National Security Council to intern and perhaps even exterminate all of black Americans, sort of the final solution to the Negro problem. The King Alfred Plan, in turn, was part of a broader-based international plan to get rid of black people in general. And there's an interesting article in the San Francisco Chronicle from Thursday, March 10th of 1988. This article has some ominous implications. It remains to be seen, how accurate the data upon which it's based is, or how accurate the data are, because the author here, Randy Schultz, is a person who's credibility we have questioned at times in the past. In fact, he appears wittingly or otherwise to have been at times a conduit for propaganda concerning AIDS by the U.S. National Security Establishment. One wonders of whether this particular article is in fact scare stories, basically, or is composed of scare stories, or whether it is an only too ominous prediction of what is going to come. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 10th of 1988, this is by Randy Schultz, headline, "Economists Predict Severe Hardship for Africa's AIDS Belt." It's Dateline, London.